my mother's name on the list, because I thought, well, I'm not really angry at her. And he said, but were you ever? You know, and I thought, well, yeah, many times, you know, like last Sunday probably, you know. So that's, I had to put the names down. He said, when I was a little bit nervous about actually writing my mother's name on the list, thinking that that might be a bad thing for her, he said, no, this inventory is designed to help you build a relationship with God and to free you from that. So this is going to be healing for you and her if she's on the list. So I then trusted him and put her name on the list, and I continued going through this process of going back through my life and thinking of all the different situations that I had been in, the years that I raced motorcycles, the years that I was in Boy Scouts, the different schools that I was in, the different jobs that I had. And in each particular case, I just would think of the people, and if I could remember at some time or other having some strong feeling of displeasure, then I jotted their name down. And a lot of times people would come into my mind that I couldn't even remember their name. I would just remember, you know, blonde guy at the bar or blonde girl at the bar that had steamed me for one reason or another. It was very easy to do, actually. So when I went through and I started thinking of all these names, I'd be writing them down. And as I went back, I remember going back into the childhood and thinking around and just some of the things that I was a little bit surprised, and I started thinking, you know, I wonder if this is God putting names in my mind. You know, I remember thinking that while I was doing my writing. I remember writing down this this kid's name from when I was like 5 years old, Stephen Percy. I remember writing his name on the list, and I wondered, you know, why did I even remember him? You know, where did that come from? I don't even, you know. I just wrote his name down because it popped into my head, and I thought to myself, I know I didn't like him, but I couldn't remember why, but I knew that I didn't like him. So I ended up having his name there, and I was moving along on this list, and I was kind of getting down towards, you know, after these several times of getting on my knees, saying the third step prayer, doing this writing process, after a few nights, thought I had kind of somewhat been through somewhat in my list, but each time I did it, I would be thinking of more names and I'd write them down. So I'd ask my sponsor, I said, now how will I know, you know, when I'm done? How am I going to know when I've got them all down here? And he said, well, it's very simple. He said, God's helping you do this. So if you're able to sit there for 20 minutes, a half an hour during this writing process where you've petitioned God for help and you've asked him and he's going to put into your mind the names that you're going to need to remember, if you can sit there for 20 minutes or so, and no more names come into your mind, he says, then you can rest assured that that God's in charge, and you're all done. And I thought, is that how God works? Does God work that simply? Is that how it is? And I'll tell you, that's exactly how it is. That's how we trust and rely on the intuitive sense from God. So that was my first step, I think, in relying and trusting and relying on God, was just completing my list of names. And then I started this list of institutions and so forth, and principles. And I didn't have a lot of institutions and principles on my list. When I say a lot, I probably about 20 or 30, something like that. And I probably ended up actually with about 300 names. That's how many names I ended up with people. And not too many principles, but I know one of the things that I was asked to do in that process was look up the definition of institution and principle, because I thought I knew what principle was. And the first one I looked up in the dictionary was like principal of a high school. I didn't even spell it right. I had to go back and see how it was spelled in the book and then find out what it was all about, this basic law of life or basic rule of conduct, because this is a moral inventory. That's what we're taking. So we're looking at these laws. And I remember like writing down that I had a resentment against honesty. Honesty is the best policy. I mean, I thought it was a good concept, but I remember being crossed with the whole idea a long time ago when, you know, it was told like the right thing to do is to own up. And when I did that, I seemed to get in more trouble. So I thought, well, I don't know if that rule is correct or not. I remember putting that one down on my list. So when I completed this list and I had my institutions, which were things like, you know, the police, insurance companies, Poland Spring Water Company, Domino's. Kind of a, you know, when I look at it now, I think, wow, you know, it's some pretty ridiculous things on there, you know, on my list. I can remember I had this young man that I'm helping. He's at my house one day, and my resentment is about four or five. My fourth step is about four or five of these one subject notebooks, and it's on my coffee table. That's where it is. It's like, doesn't own me anymore. It's like, but when I was writing the thing, I was hiding it in different spots in my house. You know, it was up under the closet one day, it was, you know, under the bed another day. I'd be thinking about it all during the day, wondering if where I had left it, where it was, and so forth. Now it's just on my coffee table because I'm just like free of the whole thing. But I remember that he's over there one day and he's looking at this my fourth step, and the one he's got is the one that had the tail end of my resentments in it. It had my fear and it had my sex. So I look over in the couch and he's reading this book, and I'm on the phone talking with another alcoholic. I look over at him and he's laughing, and I look over and he's reading this book that contains my sex conduct and my fears and so forth. And I get off the phone. I said, so what's so funny, you know? And so the resentment he was reading about was the one about Domino's pizza. And the thing that he found was amusing was, you know, I had my resentment about Domino's pizza, and David's going to talk about these turnarounds a little bit later. But in the turnaround part, he's reading my, like, dishonesty, what it came down to about Domino's. And it has me, you know, like I said, where I was dishonest is when I pulled down the window shade and made the house dark so that they would blow that 30-minute window they got, and I'd get $3 off my pizza. You know, that's what he thought was amusing. And that's the kind of, silly nonsense that I ended up having in there. But I'm very glad that I'm free of all those things today, those ones that I had in there. Of course, nobody here has ever done anything like that. So let's see. The list of names, and then after my list of names was completed, the next thing I wanted to do was we asked ourselves why we were angry. In most cases, we found that it was our self-esteem, our pocketbooks, our ambitions, our personal relationships, including sex, which were hurt or threatened. So we were sore. We were burned up. So it says, on our grudge list, we set opposite each name our injuries. Was it our self-esteem, our security, our ambitions, or our personal or sex relations which had been interfered with? And then it gives us the example of how to do that on page 65. It tells us that we were as definite as this example. And that's the example that my sponsor helped me to do. So he showed, he says, listen, what you're going to do is you're going to take the first name on your list, which was my father, and he says you're going to write his name down, and then next to that you're going to list what were the reasons that you were angry at him. What kinds of things, what reasons, what were the causes of the anger that you had towards your father? So I would think back in my life of maybe some of the earliest times that I had been angry with my father. I remember, you know, kind of a unpleasant scene in the house when I was a young kid. He was choking my mother in the hallway one night in a drunken rage. And, you know, I was out there trying to stop him from doing that. And you know, I listed that on my first resentment against him. And then I had some other things that were like that and different things that had happened through my life, different reasons from some resentments that I had against my father. I got these things down. And as I did each one, I didn't list all the causes for us. The minute I wrote down the first one, the next thing I did was take a look and find out what it was that had been injured. How had I been affected? What part of me had been affected? Was it my self-esteem, my pride, my personal relationships, my sex relationships, my ambitions, or my security? I was to ask myself which of those items had been affected. Now, of course, before I had done that, actually, the other thing that he kept telling me all the way through this was to keep consulting that dictionary. And actually, we even spent one time doing this. I looked up those seven words, and then we got together and we just went over the definitions. That was one whole meeting one time, was just going over the definitions on the seven words to find out what those things meant, those those seven items that I mentioned. And I remember, I don't think it has anything to do with it, but I wanted to do this perfectly. So I'm living down on the south of Boston, and I thought, well, I want to find out where these definitions are carved in stone. I wanted to get them at the source. And I remember taking a special trip into Boston one day to go to the Boston Public Library, and I was searching out to find, like, the biggest dictionary that was in there. I wanted to find out, you know, like where Moses wrote it down. You know, I wanted to find, you know, what the real definitions were. And did that, actually forgot my list. Looked up a word or two that I wasn't supposed to. Got home the next day to my my folks' house, and I realized that my father had the exact same dictionary at his house, so I finished my list there. So I got all those definitions, went over those ideas with my sponsor, and then I started doing them. And as I started doing these things, I'd spend a week or two on it, and then my sponsor would say, well, let's go over and see what you have written down. And he would look at some of the things that I had written down, my resentments, and he would start fine-tuning them, and eventually they ended up looking very much like the example on the book. In the very beginning, I was maybe a little bit too wordy. I had a lot of extra words built into why I was resentful and what had happened, a little tendency to explain why I was angry. You know what I mean? To show just how evil someone else was. But he got me to cut out a lot of those unnecessary words, and I ended up being just about as brief here. If you look at all these examples, I don't think they have more than 10 words when they're describing what the specific resentment is. And then I started indicating whether or not my self-esteem or these things had been affected. And as I started looking about those things and talking to him about them, like he'd go over a resentment with me that I had, and he said, don't you think your self-esteem was affected in that particular case? And I'd look at it and I'd think about it and I'd say, well, I don't think so. So then he would explain to me, like he would explain one of his resentments, and then he would tell me about how, well, because this happened to him, it made him feel like his brother treated him, his father, for instance, treated him in a particular way, where he as a child, being a son of his father, felt as though he should have been treated in a better way. So wasn't the logical conclusion is that he thought about himself as being less than from the simple fact that his father had treated him this way. And when I started thinking about that in my own life, I thought, well, that's right. If my father did do this to me, I must have been thinking to myself, why would he do this? If he had respect for me as his son, the only reason that he would do this to me must mean that I'm not very good, that I'm less than. So I could see that my self-esteem had been affected. And this was the part about being open-minded, honest, you know, willing was doing it. Open-minded was to listen to his ideas on that, to think about that in my own way and say, you're right, that did lower my self-esteem. And these are some of the things that really started to come into focus for me as I went through this fourth step as time went on, because in growing up, I can remember a lot of times my mother saying to me, you know, Brian, you have low self-esteem. You should think better of yourself. And I'd say, yeah, you know, no shit, but how do you do that? How do you think better of yourself if you think you're lousy? And I had no idea how that all took place. But this is, I was just starting to get the first piece of it. When I finished this list of resentments, and I had all these cause and effects, and I went back and looked at these, like, 300 resentments, what I noticed is that almost every time that I was angry at someone else, it actually affected my self-esteem or my pride or sometimes my security, sometimes my ambition was affected. And I started seeing how that took place. So that pretty much brings me about to the end of the cause and effects section of the book. And then the next part is the turnaround that David's going to help us out with. David?
Thanks, Brian.
The bottom of page 65, Brian read it, but it brings us right into the next section of the resentment part of the fourth step. It says, we went back to our lives. Nothing counted but thoroughness and honesty. So Brian showed us how we do that through our willingness, through our asking God, and through our sponsor's help. When we were finished, we considered it carefully. I don't know how much I focused on considering it carefully. I still didn't understand a lot of what was going on. I was still learning, as Brian said, I learned how to identify a resentment. By the time I got to this point, I didn't know how to consider it. I guess what I was doing was I was still just taking directions. I just wanted to go on. The first thing apparent was that this world and its people were often quite wrong. I could have guaranteed you that. I just wrote in all the ways in which they were wrong. And that's what I did my whole life. You know, that was the justification. You know, that I'd walk into a room and I was either better than everybody or less than everybody. And if I was less than everybody, I'd start to character assassinate them so I could feel better than them. You know, I don't know. You know, I don't know how I got like I was, but I was like that. So I could identify with that line. You know, the world and its people were often quite wrong. To conclude that other people were wrong was as far as most of us ever got. The usual outcome was that people continued to wrong us and we stayed sore. Started to get an idea of that because I went through my life. I saw, you know, I'd never seen in my life, I had never stopped to consider the picture of resentment in my life. So I'm beginning to understand that line. Sometimes it was remorse, then we were sore at ourselves. But the more we fought and tried to have our own way, the worse matters got. I didn't really understand that, but now I do understand how there was that constant battle. It was like, you know, having to put people down to make myself feel better. I mean, it was tiring to constantly have to do that. Today, I mean, it amazed me the first time I walked into a room and I looked over at somebody and I didn't have the thought that they thought they were better than me. That was a revelation for me. But I also felt the relief that I got from not having to now start in on making myself feel better, because I felt fine about myself at that point. As in war, the victory only seemed to win. Our moments of triumph were short-lived. It is plain that a life which includes deep resentment leads only to futility and unhappiness. To the precise extent that we permit these, do we squander the hours that might have been worthwhile? And that's what I was talking about. I didn't realize that I was doing it, but I started to get an idea of what they were talking about. I had the list, and I started to understand. Not that I agreed with I was wrong or could even see my part, but I started to see what they were talking about here. But with the alcoholic, whose hope is the maintenance and growth of a spiritual experience, this business of resentment is infinitely grave. We found that it is fatal. For when harboring such feelings, we shut ourselves off from the sunlight of the Spirit. The insanity of alcohol returns and we drink again. This is one of the places that I started to understand clearing away this kind of stuff. You know, there was a sunlight, a power. It was just another way that it was described to me that we do not have to, as it says, squander the hours that might have been worthwhile. This is just another reinforcement to show me that things don't have to be like that. I didn't know the difference. You know, I thought that was the way life was. If we were to live, we had to be free of anger. The grouch and the brainstorm were not for us. They may be the dubious luxury of normal men, but for alcoholics, these things are poison. You know, I was talking with somebody at lunch briefly about this. You know, that you know, non-alcoholics or people that aren't really troubled people can somehow seem to have resentments, and maybe they even process them properly, and then they get rid of them. I don't know. But I do know today that I can't even start to have resentments and hold on to one, because I do just what the book says. I fester. It just festers. You know, it won't go away until I do the steps that we will get into in step 10 when we take our inventory. We ask God to remove it. We ask for the right stuff. You know, there's a process with which I deal with any resentment today, and I'm free of it. Having made our list, it says we turn back to our resentments, our list of names and our resentments. Now it says we turn back to the list, for it held the key to the future. We were prepared to look at it from an entirely different angle. We began to see that the world and its people really dominated us. In that state, the wrongdoing of others, either fancied or real, had the power to actually kill. How could we escape? We saw that these resentments must be mastered. But how? We could not wish them away any more than alcohol. So it's telling us that, you know, at this part in the process, we need to learn how to master a resentment. My mastering a resentment in the past was figuring out in my mind how they were wrong, and then I thought I had mastered it. You know, I'd figured out just how they were wrong. I could never see my part. So what they're doing is that, like, I simply put it that when we're getting into what we call the turnaround in our resentment. So before we can move on and even begin to see our part, telling us that we need to master the anger that goes along with any resentment. It says, this was our course. We realized that the people who wronged us were perhaps spiritually sick. In my mind, it was always, they're a sick SOB. You know, in other words, putting them down to make myself right. For some reason, I always justified, and they were dead wrong, and they were a bad person, and that was the self-seeking to make myself feel better, to build that self-esteem. But here what they're telling us is, they're trying to teach us right here acceptance. You know, if somebody, like George, we talked about his sponsor, my friend, you know, he talked about his mother, and he says his mother wasn't, he didn't consider her a sick person, but when she yelled at him in an inappropriate manner and maybe was out of line, he says perhaps she was spiritually sick at that moment. So it's not like, so what they're teaching or trying to teach us is that some people who wronged us were not bad people, they were just perhaps spiritually sick. Okay. So it goes on to say that though we did not like their symptoms in the way these disturbed us, they, like ourselves, were sick too. That's another big part of my spiritual learning, was that I always expected you to be perfect and knew that I couldn't be perfect in my actions. So, God forbid you do something wrong. Okay, and this is another big thing right here, is that I started to accept people as not being perfect. And what it did was it allowed me to just be me. It started to allow me to just be me. So, though we did not like their symptoms and the way they disturbed us, they, like ourselves, were sick too. We asked God to help us show them the same tolerance, pity, and patience that we would cheerfully grant a sick friend. When a person offended, we said to ourselves, this is a sick man. How can I be helpful to him? God, save me from being angry. Thy will, not mine, be done.
I tried to do that without doing it. I just wanted to say one thing that just occurred to me. I mentioned this kid's name that I wrote down on my fourth step, this kid, Stephen Percy. And I forgot to mention what the resentment was. Is when I finally got to the list and I wrote down the resentment that I had about this five-year-old when I was 5 years old. Like, when I wrote his name down, I didn't remember what it was. But when I asked God for help again when I was doing the cause and effect, I remembered why I was angry at this kid. I was angry because he stole my tugboat. And then later on, when I get to this part and did this part that David's talking about, how we start to master the resentment and so forth, and I said this prayer beforehand when I was getting ready to do this this next section, I said this prayer. I said, God, help me to, you know, do this and so forth. And then the thought that popped into my head was, it was his tugboat. I had stole it from him. So, I mean, I was carrying that thing buried inside me forever. You know what I mean? It's just down inside, buried alive, part of my being. And this process, like, just made it slip away. So, sorry about that.
No, that's fine. You know, another good example of that would be I had resentments against my father, a lot of them, but they were, a lot of them were like, you know, he didn't teach me how to live life. And that, it doesn't necessarily make sense. I mean, today I understand that, you know, through this, we call it the angry man's prayer. And through this prayer, very quickly, once I started to understand what I was doing with mastering each resentment towards an individual, see, I could start to accept that, again, that sick people too, that, you know, he did the best he could. It's not like he, you know, he beat me and tortured me, and my father wasn't like that, but he just didn't possess the skills necessary to teach me. But I made him out to be a bad person because of that. And that is one of my spiritual faults. What this prayer is helping me to do is to start to see situations from a different angle. And this is the most important thing that we do before we even begin to see our part in any resentment. Because, I mean, I know it for me. I mean, I can't guarantee, but I hear it over and over through people that I help and other people like Brian, that this was a big turning point, these two points about, you know, accepting people for being sick and, you know, accepting and seeing things from a different point of view. Because if I stayed from keeping my point of view, I would still stay the person I was. As Brian says, that's the open-mindedness that we need to work with going through this process. So we take each resentment and we apply this to it to make sure that there's the anger, the self-righteous anger is not there. One thing I wanted to mention before going past here, and it's very important because probably 95% of my resentments, well, I don't know, had no basis for reality. It's like we began to see that the world and its people really dominate us, and that states the wrongdoing of others, fancied or real. You know, I had, in the cause and effect, I had like 10 teachers from prep school on my list, and the same resentment was after each one. They thought they were better than me. I mean, when we get to the next part, what I'm doing here, I had no idea really what they thought of me. So that resentment was fancy. I made that up in my head, but it caused me displeasure every time I saw them because I created the truth. We'll get into that now. So that's the angry man's prayer. And then it says, we avoid retaliation or argument. We wouldn't treat sick people that way. If we do, we destroy our chance of being helpful. We cannot be helpful to all people, but at least God will show us how to take a kindly and tolerant view of each and every one. That's our review. It's referring to the list again. Putting out of our minds the wrongs others had done, we resolutely look for our own mistakes. So in the fourth step papers, you know, we just list. Where had we been? Selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, or frightened. In a situation, let's take that situation with my father. You know, the definition of selfish, and again, as Brian has said, you know, I was instructed to go through, get all the definitions. The definition of selfish is concerned with oneself only, without concern for others. Again, I didn't really understand that. You know, I didn't see how I was concerned, so I needed to learn. And my sponsor said, we did a couple, and then I went home and did a few. Didn't do them real good. Sometimes you just couldn't see it, you know. Selfish, I caught on pretty quickly. You know, what was it that I wanted them to do differently? If they did that, then I wouldn't have to be resentful, very simply, you know, because, you see, they're affecting me. So there's something that they're doing. I could say very simply, They didn't act the way I wanted them to act. They didn't treat me the way I wanted to be treated. They didn't think the way I wanted them to think. They didn't do whatever it was that they were doing. It was wrong because I wanted them to act differently. I wanted what I wanted at any one moment. That goes back to in the third step, when it's like the actor wanting to run the whole show. If everybody would do as you please, everything would go just fine. That's what I believe in that thought I used to have. So, for each situation with my father, for example, you know, he just wasn't treating me. He wasn't doing what I wanted. I wanted him to do things that he wasn't capable of doing. Where was I dishonest? I wouldn't accept him for who he was. I told myself that he should be able to do this. In other words, there's no reality there. And in the self-seeking, I would act bad towards him because he wasn't doing what I wanted. Don't tell me why, but the thought in my head said, if I do this, that will get him to do what I want. Self-seeking is nothing more than the act of trying to get what we want. In under afraid, our fears fall under probably, there's three basic self-centered fears. The biggest one for me was the fear of what people think of me. The second is the fear of losing something I have. And the third is the fear of not getting what I want. So I think all my fears could fall under those three categories. And probably most of them were under fear of what people thought of me. That ties in with what Brian was talking about in how each one of these resentments, how did it affect me? Well, I was so afraid of, with the world and how everybody thought of me. Now I started to see how self-esteem, and we always were supposed to put fear in parentheses. So now I could start to see how, my self-esteem was affected because I started out feeling so bad about myself when I woke up in the morning, and a lot of these resentments were just driven by fear to begin with. I was always in that state. So if I walk into a room and, like those teachers, a turnaround on those teachers would be, I wanted them to think differently about them. I wanted them to like me. That would be the turnaround on the teacher who thought he was better than me. Because in my mind, I had displeasure because he was thinking bad things about me. Under the dishonest category, this one was very evident to me. I had no idea what he was thinking. At the end of my writing, I could very simply put that. In the beginning, I did elaborate a little more because I said, he gave me no reason to believe that. I didn't know what he was thinking, but he also didn't give me any reason to believe that he disliked me. It was me who started the bad relations. That's where another thing in our cause and effects, where it affects me. It affects my personal relations. I didn't even give that guy a chance for us to have a friendship because my fear immediately started the conflict between us. So that was the dishonest. Under self-seeking, I'd give him a dirty look, but I'd give him a look, I'd ignore him, I'd talk bad about him. And this is all that self-esteem is beaten down so low, and my head's creating a lie to tell me what this guy's thinking, so now I have a resentment. And so I couldn't live with low self-esteem. I spent my whole day building my self-esteem up. Most of it was putting people down in my mind or talking bad about them. And the fear I just talked about, I was afraid of what he thought of me. It's not that it was valid because I didn't have any proof of it, but that's why they say this state, either fancied or real, actually had the power to kill. There's a lot of situations in these turnarounds where we would sometimes people actually did things that were actually harmful and they were wrong. What do we do? In a case where, let's say, somebody just out of the blue beat me up. where was I selfish? Now, that's a tough one. A lot of people go, well, where was I? You know, what was my part in it? Says, well, you know, did I do anything to, you know, I wanted them not to do that. That was the basis of what was going on. Not to mean that it was, not to mean that I could have changed anything because they were the ones who took the action. The point is that I just need to see that I wanted them not to do that. The problem was is that I just didn't accept it at that, at them being wrong and doing something. I went on to be self-seeking, and I caused myself spiritual harm by lashing back. I wouldn't accept the situation and just, I wouldn't take care of myself and tell somebody what had happened. And then in the self-seeking, again, spiritually, I'd put them down. I would, you know, again, lashing back might be the self-seeking. And then in the fear, I mean, all kinds of fears were going on there. It's not just the fear of losing my physical well-being, you know. I fear of what people are thinking of me, watching me get beat up, fear of what they're going to, others are going to think when they find out, you know, there was a whole thing going on. So you can see that even justified resentments like that, not that any really just resentment is justified, but that we just didn't react even normally to situations like that. So we need to look at them all, because I did still have the resentment against the guy. You know, it brought on that displeasure. Let's find out what my page is here. So those are situations, so we listed, you know, where were we selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and afraid. So though the situation had not been entirely our fault, we tried to disregard the others, person involved entirely. Where were we to blame? The inventory was ours, not the other man's. We saw our faults, we listed them. We placed them before us in black and white. We admitted our wrongs honestly and were willing to set these matters straight. And that's my experience with the turnarounds. In the turnarounds, you know, what Brian had talked about in the cause and effects, the turnarounds was the point in my, really in this inventory process where it's like when I had taken the third step and I said I had this feeling that something was going to be different. At the end of the cause and effects, I didn't really get that feeling because I actually didn't feel real bad, but I didn't feel real good. I hadn't discovered anything new. When I got done with my turnarounds, there was another one of those feelings like I had learned things about me, and it was only through the openness and honesty and the willingness, and I know through asking God each time for the help that I was a different person at that point. I was also reminded that I'm only taking an inventory. And that, again, self-knowledge was not going to solve my problem. So I needed to be very careful here, that I needed to continue on with this work. You know, the next section is fear, and boy, that can keep a lot, you know, that kept me from doing a lot of things in my life. So I was just reminded not to try and think too much, to absorb what was going on in my spiritual conditioning here, and then just to take the next direction. Anything you wanted to say on your experience with this, Brian?
Sure. I think that when I was doing this portion of the work, finding out where I was to blame, I guess that's, I would have to say that when we're talking about the psychic change, that's where it started happening for me. The change in the way I started thinking, because this is where I really started to discover some about the truth in stock. It was one thing to write down a resentment and say, so-and-so did this or so-and-so did that, and to have all those things listed and to say, oh, yes, that did in fact affect my self-esteem and so forth, and it affected my security. Well, to some degree, that was all knowledge that I had to some degree already, kind of knowing a lot of those things, knowing that people had made me angry. But in this part, in becoming free of the anger, by finding out where I am to blame, that's where the discovery was. That's when I started to find out about the real truth in stock. And that's when I started looking at these things very carefully, this selfishness, dishonesty. And those are key. The fear, of course, is the feeling that happens that we'll talk about in a while. But the selfishness, that is the root of the problem. And, you know, David said that he wanted to be, I forget now actually what he said, but the thing that popped into my mind was that in saying, I remember going over one with my sponsor, and the way that it made it simple for me, these four words, selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and frightened, the questions that I said is selfish, what did I want? Dishonest, where was the truth? Self-seeking, what did I do? And I remember saying, answering the question, selfish, what did I want? And keeping in mind the definition of selfish is a concern with one's own welfare without any regard for anybody else. When I wrote down the answer, you know, in this particular resentment that I'm thinking about, my sponsor said, well, what did you want? And I said, well, you know, I just wanted to be treated like anybody else. And he said, well, you know, I don't think that's true, Brian. He said, in this case here, it sounds like you wanted to be treated better than everybody else. And when he said that, I kind of swallowed hard. But as I thought about it, I realized that, you know, when I was singled out in school and you know, grammar school for this or for that, and the teacher yelled at me for doing this or doing that, you know, the selfishness wasn't so much that, you know, of course everybody liked the teacher to like them, but my selfishness was that I wanted them to like me better than they liked anybody else in the class. I wanted them to let me get away with anything I wanted to do. Essentially, I wanted to run the show. I wanted to be in charge of the class. I wanted to tell the teacher what to do. I never wanted to be treated like anybody else. That's kind of the crazy, and when I start looking at it in turnarounds and I start to see just how unreasonable my selfish wants are, that kind of makes them, they start looking really crazy to me when I start seeing just how outlandish my goals are, you know, and later on, whatever it would be, if a friend of mine had a girlfriend, it wouldn't be so much that I'd want her, I'd want everybody's girlfriend. I really wasn't happy if anybody had one, you know what I mean? I wanted them all the girls, to be interested in me. Just one friend way over there, if he had an interest in this girl and she was interested in him, I would be angry that she wasn't interested in me. You know, that's the kind of unreasonable degree of selfishness that I saw in this turnaround process, and that's what helps you set you free. Because when you start seeing just how crazy you really are, because what you're doing then too is this dishonesty question, is you're also you're telling yourself a lot of lies, you know. And this lie about picking up a bottle of Heineken and, you know, not making you drunk, well, that one seems real simple for me today. You know, that's a lie I can see. I've been restored to sanity. But these other ones that I started discovering in this part of the writing, these other lies, you know, like the ones that I had mentioned a little bit earlier, that the ability that I had to tell what other people were thinking. Well, that's one of the lies I discovered. I don't know what other people are thinking. I have no idea what they're thinking. I might be able to sense anger. I might be able to sense fear or something like that. I can sense feelings out of somebody. Today, I can look into people's eyes today after doing this process, and I can tell you whether you got love there or fear. I know it's in one of those two categories. I can recognize it. But as far as knowing what you're thinking, I don't have a clue. And that was one of the lies that I'd write down. I thought I knew what this person thought, you know. I thought this is like David's saying, that I thought this is what this person thought of me. And that was a lie that drove me to make a lot of rash decisions in my life, caused me to do a lot of crazy things. And that was my self-seeking behavior. If you want to know what that self-seeking behavior is, what is self-seeking behavior? How do you go about making yourself feel better about yourself? If you know, the alcoholic is the guy that has, at least I am at any rate, I'm the guy that has, like, in one breath, can walk into this room and think, I'm better than anybody else. You know, I can come in here with that possibility, you know, pre-doing this process, I should say, but come in here with that feeling of pride that we looked at the definition in here, feeling of pride and unreasonably high opinion of our own self-worth, to walk into a room and think I'm better than anybody else. And somebody could just say one little comment to me, like, you know, those are awful thick glasses. And I'd just, like, sink. I'd be the lowest thing in the room. I would think I was going to die. I wanted to crawl into a hole in the floor. You know, that's the kind of range.
Me pulling the shade down and watching the dominoes guy shoot down the street and checking my time to let him run off the clock so I can get my $3. Obviously, I gotta admit that level of dishonesty. But the dishonesty that I really have in my life, the one, it's like me. That's the one I gotta look for, is the one when I'm telling myself lies. I'm telling myself that other people's opinions of me are more important than my opinion of my own self-worth. I would do a turnaround on a situation. I would be angry at this person over there because they were acting strange. And I don't want them associated with me, because if anybody thinks that person's with me, they're going to think I'm no good. Now, that doesn't work. That's a lie based in insanity, that what somebody else does has some effect on my self-worth. Now, I didn't know that until I started doing this process, and I realized that I'd been telling myself those lies, that what somebody else does has some effect on my self-worth. It doesn't. Only if I think it does. That's when it does. So today I choose to, you know, believe the truth, that my opinion of my self-worth, that's more important than other people's opinion of me. That's what I based that on. And it was in this process here that I was able to discover those truths with the guidance of my sponsor that helped me do that. Because in the beginning, this was very hard for me to see things that I had never seen this way before. And then to come away from this thing, to finish this process of mastering resentments, to end up having all those people on that list and not being angry at any of them, that's nice. That's a nice feeling. You know that I could, when I started getting into this, I could go over to just go over and see my parents on a Sunday morning and decide to go out and have breakfast with my mother and father. And I'll tell you, before the hour that I spent with them, the hour and a half, before that was through, I mean, I was ready to kill them. I couldn't stand being with them anymore. And, I mean, even sitting at the table, the sound of my father chewing could send me into a rage, you know? I mean, I'm crazy. I can tell you that much. I am crazy. And that, I would get so angry, you know, but, you know, deep down, I love my mother and father, and this drove me crazy that I would end up getting angry over situations like this. And I could be with my younger brother, who I absolutely love today, and just, we can't get enough of each other. But prior to this process, I couldn't spend any more than an hour or two with him when we were ready to kill each other. And I never knew why. It was in doing this process here that I was able to see my behavior, the things that I was doing, my self-seeking behavior, my unreasonable selfish desire, the lies that I was telling myself, that I had to have him think like me, you know, and if I didn't prove I was right, you know, all these, like, crazy ideas that I had that I discovered while doing this process, where that's where my insanity lied, and the lies that I told myself, that's where my insanity was. And this was the discovery process to find out exactly what that insanity was. And now when I spend time with my family, it's beautiful. I mean, I don't have any problem at all. I mean, I just love being with them today. You know, everything has changed. And the only thing that's changed is me. I've changed the way I behave. That's what's happened as a result of this discovery process right here. So I think, does that take us down to about, okay.
Let's take a 15-minute break and we'll be back.
Thanks. Hello, everybody. Welcome back. We're going to talk about the next part of the fearless in moral inventory is going to be on fear. And doing this part of the inventory for me made quite a difference. I pieced a lot of things together for me that were very separate beforehand. When we started the process and I was explaining the how I listed my cause and effects, the part where I had listed down things like self-esteem and ambitions and so forth, the one thing that I had neglected to say at that point was something my sponsor asked me to do. Is he said, when you write down self-esteem and these effects, he said, write down the word fear and put it in brackets next to the effects. He said, I don't want you to worry about it. He said, I don't even want you to look up and find out what the definition of fear is or pay any attention to it. He says, I just want you to accept this and do what he said, basically, because that's the way his sponsor had done it with him. And he said, when we get to the next section, we'll see where the word comes from and why it's there. So that's where we are now. We're on this fear section on page 67. At the bottom of the page, it says, notice that the word fear is bracketed alongside the difficulties with Mr. Brown, Mrs. Jones, the employer, and his wife. And if you look at page 64, you'll notice that in those resentments, you've got, you know, Mr. Brown, he had paid attention to my wife. That affected my sex relations, my self-esteem, and then the word fear is bracketed there. And it's bracketed alongside each one of those resentments. Fear is right there. So sponsor went over this this section with me, and he said, he said, we're going to go back and look through that section. He said, and he used to tell me as we were going through this inventory, he said, this thing's going to be a bit of a reference book for you. You're going to be able to look back at it and find more information, just as David had indicated when he was doing what we call the turnaround portion of the part. He said that we'll go back and, you know, it says we look, turn back to the list for it holds the key. And once again, we're going to turn back to the list here because it says, notice that the word fear is bracketed. So he asked me, he said, let's do this the way we did resentments, and we'll start by getting a list of the fears down. And he said, a way you'll find these fears, he said, is go back to your cause and effects portion of your inventory, look where that word fear is bracketed, and take a look at what kind of fear that is, and then start making a list. So what I did is I started going back, and the thing that I was really amazed at is when I had wrote my cause and effects, I had no idea why I was writing the word fear down. Fear was very much a mystery to me when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. I would listen to people speak from the podium, and quite often somebody would say, you know, they'd be speaking, and they'd say how fear ruled their lives. And I would think to myself, well, that's kind of silly, you know. Fear doesn't rule my life. I didn't see that at all as far as being fear being much of a problem with me. I thought, well, geez, you know, in the racing of motorcycles and so forth, and even when I was drinking and all the crazy things I did when I was drinking, a lot of people would have said, oh, Brian, he's crazy. He's not afraid of anything. So I was under this impression that fear was not like a problem for me. But I had overlooked a lot of little things in my life that, you know, I wasn't paying any attention to that come under this fear category. I can give you an example. I was at a meeting one day when I was going to Alcoholics Anonymous. I was court ordered, and I'd been going to this one particular discussion meeting. It was on Tuesday at noontime in Norwell, Mass. It was a discussion meeting. Actually, the speaker there, one of the guys that spoke all the time, he was a guy that I liked his conception of God, and I used to go to this meeting every Tuesday. and I liked it, and I knew that I would never have to speak at this meeting, because the way it operated was there was a couple of people up at the front table, they had tables around the side of the room, and what would happen is they'd already have it worked out somehow. I didn't understand how Alcoholics Anonymous worked, but I knew these guys that were running the show, they got the thing working, whereas, you know, a different person would get up and he'd start the meeting off by telling his, whatever he was telling his story or whatever. And then after that, what they would do is then people would raise their hand if they wanted to speak. And so I quickly understood that as long as I didn't raise my hand or look at anybody the wrong way, then I wasn't going to have to do any talking at this meeting. So I always felt very comfortable there, and I always got a nice message there. I always felt, you know, helped and felt, got a little new information, got a little bit more information about how to live sober and so forth. Well, one day, the guy that was usually there, he's gone. He's at, like, the big convention in San Diego, the big AA convention. He's gone. And another guy gets up the room and he says, you know, I don't like to talk. So he says, I'm going to do this a little bit differently. I'm going to go around the room and have everybody, you know, introduce themselves and talk. And I, when he said that, I sat there and I thought to myself, now what's he mean by that, everybody in the room? And I was sitting there, and then they started, you know, he did it, and it started going around, and it's going down. And I said, well, it's just the folks on the tables, not the people that are in the seats where I'm sitting out in the middle. It's just the people at the table. They're apparently, they're part of this group, evidently, you know, and that's, it's just going to go to them. And then all of a sudden, it left the tables, and it starts coming out into the seats that I was sitting in. And I thought, oh, my God, this is going to work its way around over here. I'm looking at the clock and the rate of time it's going, you know, this little thread's going through the meeting. And I started getting horrified. Now, take into account, I've been sober now for about a year. I'm a professional businessman. I've talked to groups of engineers before, and here I am sitting in this Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, and I'm ready to flip. I'm thinking to myself, what am I going to do? What's going to happen when this thing gets over to me? I started getting so nervous, I said, well, I'm getting out of here. I'm going to go down I'll leave. I'll just get up and walk out the stairs. And then I thought to myself, everybody's going to know that I'm leaving, that in this room is going to know I'm leaving because I'm scared. So I started thinking, how am I going to get out of this thing? And then I started thinking, I can go out into the kitchen, pretend I'm getting coffee, there's stairs that go out the back, and I'll just slip down that way, and nobody will be the wiser. And then I thought, no, there are a couple people in here that know me. They'll see me go into that kitchen, and they'll notice I never came out again. So I thought, I can't do that. So I just thought, I just stayed there, frozen in my seat, and then it eventually came over to me, and all I said was, I'm Brian. But when I said that, I had sweat dripping off my forehead. My face was bright red, and I was about ready to die. And after I just said Brian, and I was just praying, I hope somebody else starts talking, and it just goes away. And it started different people, and by the time the break came, I could just about breathe, and I could just about hear things by that time. So, and I didn't think I had any fear. You know, how do you rationalize that? How can you go through an experience like that, then go to the next meeting and hear somebody talking about fear ruling their lives and say, oh, that's silly. How can fear rule your life? But this is where this thing started to work for me, this part of the process, because it was really this identification of fear, learning these different sorts of fears that I had and how they worked. And I found them by going back to that original list that I had worked on, and then when I looked at each individual thing and I saw self-esteem, and I looked at the name of the person, the cause of the resentment, I saw the self-esteem, I looked at it, and instantly I said, I was afraid of not being good enough. And then I would look at another one, and I'd see the word security, and I'd say, wow, I was afraid of not being able to pay my rent or get along in life and so forth. And then I would look at another resentment and I'd see ambition listed, and I would see, wow, I was afraid that I wasn't good enough, that I might not have been able to do it, that I might not have been good enough to do this or play music or whatever it was. But I started to see these fears like instantly. And the reason I could see them instantly is because I had done the work that preceded this portion of the step. I had done those turnarounds where I had spent that time answering that question on each turnaround, how was I frightened? What was I afraid of? And now these things were starting to click, how they interacted with that the effect. You know, and it says, notice that the word fear is bracketed alongside the difficulties. And if you take a look at that, well, you know what I always thought the difficulties were? I thought the difficulty was, like, you know, the employer was unreasonable, that he was unjust, and he was overbearing and so forth. I thought that was the difficulty, that, you know, my father didn't treat me the way I wanted him to, that, you know, my friends didn't do what I wanted them to do. I thought that was the difficulty. And actually what the difficulties are is that my self-esteem gets affected by what I think other people think or what I think other people do or what I think other people think of me. That's what affects my self-esteem. It affects my personal relationships with other folks, and it affects everything about who I am is affected, and that's my difficulty. And that's the thing I can solve. I can never really solve what other people do. I'll never be able to change what they do. But the thing I can change is how I react to these things, what my reaction to, you know, so that I do not have difficulties. Remember the third step prayer? It said, God, I offer myself to thee, to build with me, to do with me as thou will, to relieve me of the bondage of self, so that I may better do thy will, take away my difficulties so that victory over them will bear witness to those I will help of thy power, thy love, thy way of life. Because of doing this and doing this third step prayer, this started making sense to me more and more as I was going through this inventory. And each time saying the third step prayer before I spoke, before I wrote, I started to see more and more truth. So after I had my list of fears down and remembering that thoroughness and honesty counted, you know, I had to put down some of the fears that I was really ashamed of writing, you know. I wrote down that I was afraid, fear of being gay. It says, it talks about fears, even though we have no resentment in connection with them on page 68. It talks about that, fears even though we had no... So I would write down, after I finished the list, after going through my resentment, I would write down these other fears that were kind of like very personal and things that I was very nervous about and very afraid about. But I wanted to make sure that I was thorough and honest. Remember what Bill Wilson said in the beginning of the chapter, How It Works? He said, we beg of you to be thorough from the very start. And I wanted to do that. I wanted to be thorough. So I put down the fears, no matter how uncomfortable I may have felt about them, I put them on my list. And then after I had that list completed, I talked to my sponsor, and he said, well, now we're going to talk about these words that it talks about in the fear. It says, about fear, it says, this short word somehow touches about every aspect of our lives. It's an evil and corroding thread. The very fabric of our existence is shot through with it. It set in motion trains of circumstances which brought us misfortune we felt we didn't deserve. But did not we ourselves set the ball rolling? Sometimes it says we think fear ought to be classed with stealing. It seems to cause more trouble. So it says, we reviewed our fears thoroughly. We put them on paper, even though we had no connection, no resentment in connection. We asked ourselves why we had them. You know, wasn't it because self-reliance had failed us? Self-reliance was as good as far as it went, but it didn't go far enough. Some of us once had great self-confidence, but it doesn't fully solve the fear problem or any other. And when it made us cocky, it was worse. So I had to start going back and go through my list and look at these fears and to see, ask myself why I had them. Where did they begin? How did they start? And when I went back, I would find out in my book where I first wrote it. And then when I looked at the fear, which fear simply is a feeling. That's all it really is. It's a feeling. That's what fear is. Love is a feeling. And I've experienced both, and I can tell you which one I like better. It's love. Fear, to me, is not a good feeling. And the solution that I found in this process is that I don't have to have fear anymore, because I now have the kit of spiritual tools that help me eliminate it. And I found these by going back and start taking each one of these fears that had presented itself in my life, by going back through, finding out how it originated, where it had started. In childhood, the first time, you know, I had fear of somebody else, what they thought of me. The first time I had, fear of women. You know, I would trace the first time I had been terrified about women all my life. You know, the first time I go back to looking at the fear of what women thought of me. I remember going to the first time was in second grade when some girl who was about four times my size wanted me to be a boyfriend, and I was like horrified, you know, and I remember writing that one down about that. I couldn't understand what she had in mind or what that was going to be like. But by the time it was, more in my interest to have a girlfriend, and I got to, like, the junior high dance, and then I went over to a girl and I said, will you dance? And she said, no. I experienced fear. And you know what? It sucks. It was a horrible feeling, just absolutely dreadful, the feeling that I felt when she said no. Because with my ability to know what other people are thinking and to read their minds, it was very easy for me to know instantly what she thought of me and what that meant about me. You know, I had that ability to do that. It's very, very keen in me. So I took that truth, analyzed it immediately, and I thought, well, I'd rather die, you know, than do this again. So I may have, so by having that ability to make that decision on my own, and thinking that the result of this means that I'm no good, then I thought, well, after enough time went by and the fear came up again, and I figured, I got to get over this. I got to get somebody to dance with me at the, you know, by the time I get to the junior prom, you know what I mean, or senior prom, whatever it is, you know, I mean, the pressure kept building. You know, I had more fear about what people were thinking about me because I wasn't dancing with girls. You know what I mean? I just got fear going from, both angles. And I would try and do that again because at this time the fear of what people were thinking of me was worse than the fear of what the girl would say no. So I'd ask again, say no, and I'd get that fear again. I'd say, wow, this is no good. So that's actually when I discovered alcohol. Right about then is when I discovered alcohol. And the first time I took the alcohol, the promises started coming true for me.
Yeah.
My fear of other people's opinions just went away. I started to understand the word serenity. You know, my fear of other things just started to disappear. A new sense of ease and happiness flowed over me. It's I'd found the answer, you know. And when I took that alcohol, I also found that, wow, it was no trouble asking a girl to dance either. That was a piece of cake. I might not have been able to stand up, but I didn't have any trouble asking them to dance. I didn't even care if they said no. So as I went back and I traced my fears and saw how this fear built all the way through my life, it's crazy. And that's what I was doing. I was writing a little bit of story about how this set in motion trains the circumstances which I thought I didn't deserve. And I saw how each one of these fears were all interrelated to each other. You know, I had fear of playing ball sports when I was young. I don't have very good depth perception because of my vision. You know, and the first time I played baseball and went to swing at the ball, like it was by me when I swung. You know what I mean? And I felt terrible. People laughed. And I immediately sensed that feeling, which is horrible. And I found my solution to that. Well, just don't play baseball anymore. That'll solve that. And then that fear just got worse and worse, and that complicated its way right into high school. I can remember being a senior in high school. I was walking down the hall. The gym teacher spotted me. And he said, Brian, He said, you haven't been to gym class, ever. And he realized that, you know, here I'm a senior in high school, and I haven't made it to gym class yet. He says, you have to, and he got angry with me, and he even brought me into the men's room, and he started pounding in my chest, you know, with his finger, telling me that if I didn't go to gym class, I wasn't going to graduate from high school. Well, by then, this guy had no idea that him pounding his finger in my chest, that fear that he was trying to drive home was just minor compared to the fear I had about playing soccer or anything like that that had would involve catching a ball. So I just said, well, you do what you need to do, but I'm not going. And that was the end of that, you know. But that's how that fear develops all the way through your life, you know, and one thing leads to another. And I never had the solution to fear. I never knew what to do about all these different fears that interplayed all through my life until I started doing this work. And in here it says, perhaps there is a better way. We think so. For we are now on a different basis. We are on the basis of trusting and relying upon God. We trust infinite God rather than our finite selves. We are in the world to play the role He assigns. Just to the extent that we do it as we think He would have us and humbly rely on Him, does He enable us to match calamity with serenity. So I started thinking about these fears with my sponsor's help, and he said, well, perhaps there is a better way. What should you have done instead? And I started looking at these fears, and I said, well, you know, back when that girl said no, you know, maybe I had a choice here. Maybe I could have went to my parents, and maybe I could have discussed that with them. Maybe I could have done that rather than making up my own mind and being the final alpha and omega on what that meant. Maybe I could have discussed that with someone. And the bottom line here is I could trust and rely on God. And what God thinks of me, that's more important than what other people think of me. So I started seeing that I had a solution to all these fears. There were things that I could do today. I did not have to believe the lies that I had believed. When I went back and researched them through my turnarounds, I went back and I looked, and then I was able to see what the fear was. I was able to see the selfish thought that I had that drove the fear. I was able to see the dishonest thought, the lie, that was at the bottom of it. I was able to see the self-seeking action, which is the trains the circumstances that I set in motion. I was able to see now that there was a different way. There was something else I could do now. I didn't have to believe the lies anymore. There was another way to act. I could trust and rely upon God. It says, we never apologize to anyone for depending upon our Creator. We can laugh at those who think spirituality is the way of weakness. Paradoxically, it is the way of strength. The verdict of the ages is that faith means courage. All men of faith have courage. They trust their God. We never apologize for God. Instead, we let Him demonstrate through us what He can do. We ask Him to remove our fear and direct our attention to what He would have us be. At once, we commence to outgrow fear. And that's my solution for those fears today. I've identified the lies that I believed. I know what the truth is today. And I have God. And I can change that reaction to fear. I can do something differently. Fear is not a mystery to me anymore today. If I get up at this table like this morning, you know, I walk up here getting ready to start this thing, want to make sure it goes right, and then I'm sensing this fear while I'm sitting here for a few minutes. Well, you know what? When I feel that sense of fear, I know today that what that means is there is a selfish thought involved. And what that selfish thought is, I want to really impress everybody. I want them to really think I'm the cat's pajamas, you know? That's what I want to do. That's the selfish thought. And then I see the lie there, and I say, no, I don't want that God. I'm not interested in that. I just want to do what you want me to do, God, and I'm not self-reliant. I don't want to be up here just Brian himself. I'm not interested in that. I'm up here with God, and I let God demonstrate through me what God can do, rather than me being the only one here, because I can't do it on my own. It would be too impossible for me, and it's too much work in my life to try and do that anymore, to be on my own. But with God, I can accomplish anything. With God at my side, I can let God demonstrate through me what God can do. So then, if you're not happy with what I say up here or what I do, you can take that up with God. But by the same token, if you are happy with what I say and do, you can thank God too, because that's my purpose. That's why I'm here. I'm letting God demonstrate through me. And how much serenity do I get to feel? How much serenity? You know, I had a life full of calamity, and now I got serenity. And it says, we're able to match the calamity with serenity by the extent of how we trust and rely on God. If I trust God a whole bunch, I get a whole bunch of serenity. And that's the choice I have to do today, is this program has taught me how to do this right here, how to let go and let God. When I got to this program and I saw that, it didn't make any sense to me. I said, how do you do it? But because of this inventory, I know how to do it today. It's given me the practical tools which enable me to let go and let God. And that is freedom from bondage of self. Thanks.
Thanks, Brian.
David?
thanks, Brian. Beginning of the fourth step, it says we're going to find how self manifested in various ways is what had defeated us. Well, in resentments we saw, number one, selfish. You know, that was really the root. And in the fear part, you know, we're concerned with ourselves. You know, and what happened was I created the lies, as Brian was talking about. And then he showed wonderfully how it manifested ourselves in our lives. Now the third part of the fourth step, sex. Didn't understand what they were going to get at in this part of the fourth step. I didn't know why they needed to be so blunt about it, you know. Just, you know, that was something you didn't really talk about, especially in like relationships, you know. You can't talk about sex, just do it, you know, that kind of thing. But, you know, I started to understand, well, especially what this book is about, they're not talking about relationships here. Relationships fall under the first two categories. You know, the self-centered thinking of my mind and the fear that drove me was the reason why relationships didn't work. What they're talking about here is our sex conduct. It says, now about sex. Many of us needed an overhauling there. But above all, we tried to be sensible on this question. It was so easy to get way off track. Here we find human opinions running to extremes, absurd extremes perhaps. One set of voices cry that sex is the lust of the lower nature, a base necessity of procreation. Then we have the voices that cry for sex and more sex, who bewail the institution of marriage, who think that most of the troubles of the race are traceable to sex causes. They think we do not have enough of it, or that it isn't the right kind. They see its significance everywhere. One school would allow man no flavor for his fare, and the other would have us all on a straight pepper diet. We want to stay out of this controversy. We do not want to be the arbitrator of anyone's sex conduct. We all have sex problems. We'd hardly be human if we didn't. What can we do about them? Again, it's basically telling me, you know, how, when, where, and all that is not really the point here. We're still looking for how self manifested itself in various ways,
was what had caused my sex problems. First question. So it says we reviewed our conduct over the years past. So it doesn't say in the book, you know, to make a list of sex relations, but that's what we do. We just think we can either go back. Some people, these people might be on resentment list, some might not, but we make a separate list of everybody we've had sex with. You can, you know, if you start getting into fantasies, you know, and other types of the thinking parts of sex, you could probably go on. If I was doing a fantasy list, I'd still be writing today. You know, so, you know, I had to, you know, again, the whole point of this process is to clear away enough blockage so we can get to God. You know, we need to have enough on here that we can see the truth. So when I did my work here, all that fantasy stuff, when I did the work on fears and the work on the selfish and resentments, learning about that, I could see where that kind of thinking was wrong. You know, it was untrue. So it says we reviewed our conduct over years past. So I made my list, and then it asks us 9 questions. Of course, the first one is, where had we been selfish? Concerned with myself only, you know, and we're talking about the sex act, you know, where, I mean, I know for me that I didn't stop to think about this that much, but even when I knew this part was coming up, I knew that I just wanted sex from people, you know, and I knew that, putting relationships aside, I knew it wasn't normal, you know, I mean, I knew that I couldn't communicate and all that, but what they're asking here is, you know, what did I want? Where was I concerned with myself only in each one of these situations? What I want to do is I'm going to go through the questions and talk about them, and then I've got some examples that I'd like to give you. Where was I dishonest? You know, where was I selfish? Again, was just like in the other part of in the resentment part, you know. Basically, in most of the cases, I wanted sex from this person. You know, some people will say, I wanted emotional security and sex. And I even wrote that in quite a few of them. But I realized today that really what I wanted was the emotional security came out of the fear part, which once I tie this all together, I see that. So for each relation, really, I just wanted sex from them. Doesn't matter why. The point is I wanted sex from them. Under the dishonest category, you know, like Brian was talking about in the turnarounds, you know, what was the lie I told myself? You know, did I lie to them? Oh, I love you, dear. You know, just so I could get what I want. In other words, they don't use the question in this part of the fourth step, where was I self-seeking? In other words, I mean, in a way, it would be great to have that question in here, but I think we answer it when we're answering the dishonest and the inconsiderate question. It's showing us, excuse me, what we did to get what we want. In other words, most of the time, I found I didn't really even like the person. It was just that the opportunity was there. In other words, I wasn't being honest with myself. I wasn't being honest with them. I would either lie to them and then lie to myself, telling me it was okay. What about the case where somebody's married and they put the moves on me? That was a perfect example where my head would say, hey, I didn't do anything. They put the moves on me. Let me go on because I do have an example of that. I hate to admit it, but I did go out with a married woman. Where was I inconsiderate? Inconsiderate means to not consider somebody else. I mean, the definition is pretty easy, but I never stopped to think about that. In most of these cases, I never stopped to think about their feelings. And then when I reviewed it, you know, I mean, I could see pretty quickly that, you know, the way I was going about this, when this all started to come together, that I didn't care. I don't care what they wanted afterwards. I didn't care whether I had lied to them, and that once sex was over, that they would be hurting. You know, I didn't consider them at all. because it's like the blinders. You know, you put the blinders on and I want something, I'm going to go get it. I don't care what happens to anybody else. That's the fourth question. Whom did I hurt? You know, I hurt most of the people I went out with because of the second and third question. You know, through deceiving them and not being honest with them and then not considering their feelings, you know, I hurt them. There are lots of times when I would hurt their friends, some of their friends. You know, their friends could be really concerned that I'm manipulating this person and they see it. You know, it's getting a little picky, but sometimes they really stand out that I hurt their friends. I hurt their children. You know, some of the people that went out had children. And, you know, I didn't consider them at all. And therefore, in not considering them, I probably hurt more than I really know about. But I really can only take an inventory of what I know about. I can consider it, and I can talk about it, and I can pray to God about it. You know, there were so many times when, like Brian had said, you know, when the truth wasn't evident, I would sit and pray about it. In each one of these cases, you know, before I did them, I would ask God. I'd do the third step prayer, but I would ask all the time for the truth to be revealed to me, because, you know, it just didn't come clear because I became willing. So, you know, and God did reveal to me. And so I would just make sure, you know, that is there anybody I missed in hurting, you know, in this case? The next three questions are, they're actually stated as yes or no questions, and I'm a believer that it doesn't really matter whether you answer in yes or no or you write out how you did it. It says, did we unjustifiably arouse jealousy, suspicion, or bitterness? In my case, I very rarely put down jealousy because, I mean, you know, Brian has explained how there are certain fears about him that was so pronounced. One of them with me in relationship, in let's say that pursuit for sex, was I was afraid to make them jealous. They were afraid of what they wouldn't like me anymore and they wouldn't give me what I wanted. So I didn't do a lot of that. I did a couple times, and I have a couple examples. Where was I aroused suspicion? In that was similar to jealousy. In the case where, you know, I didn't want to stir up the pot because my self-esteem was so low that in an instant somebody was going to leave me. So I didn't want to chance that. So I was that real good self-seeker, and that, you know, I was kind when wanting to get something, you know, as they talk about in, again, the third step. Jealousy, suspicion, bitterness. Bitterness, you know, is bringing out a distasteful reaction from somebody. In other words, if I am bringing up an immediate, almost like a resentment or anger, you know, displeasure on their part. You know, when I just walk out the door after having sex, I've hurt them, I've lied to them, I've used them, I've hurt them, and I walk out the door, I think they're bitter. You know, they may be hurt, but they are bitter too. You know, and again, it really had to make it in the cases that I knew about. I couldn't make up in my head what I knew about. So I answered those out. And I actually wrote out, you know, where I thought I had done those things. The next question is, where was I at fault? In the beginning, I you know, I worded things out. I tried to figure things out. I take that question as we sum up the top questions. If you almost like read them right down, like I keep doing, you know. I wanted sex. I lied to her to get it. I didn't consider her feelings at all. You know, what is that telling me? That is where I'm at fault. That's one way to describe it. So over my writing, I would write that out. The one thing that came to me, and this wasn't from my sponsor, I truly believe that this came to me right from God because it described where I was at fault in this. For some reason, I started writing down the word I was lacking in moral character. You know, and that really, when that came to me, it really hit me that that's what I was doing. And I also thought, geez, this is a moral inventory. And I just, it was different for me. And then I would start adding the words, I was lacking in moral character and integrity. You know, my personal integrity is one of the things, and when I said, whom did I hurt? I was always hurting me, and I didn't really see that in the beginning. I said, who am I hurting? You know? Well, I was hurting myself because I was taking myself out of reality. You know, I always wanted to be, quote, normal. I always wanted to have good sex relations, including the relationships. But what I was doing was I was settling for less, and I was telling myself that this is okay. Someday I'll have what I want. When in reality, I wasn't doing that. I was hurting myself. I was not thinking of well, why don't you learn how to have, you know, why don't you work on yourself? Why don't you work on your fears? Why don't you work, do this and that? And then, no, my head kept telling me, no, just go do this, that's okay. So I kept hurting myself. And what should we have done instead? Now, in almost all the cases, I should not have been, I've been with that person. That's the simple way to put it. You know, in some of the cases, I worded it a little differently. You know, if, because some of the people I really do think I like to begin with, but very quickly, since they didn't act and treat me and do everything I wanted, I very quickly disliked people. So now the only reason I'm staying there is for sex.
And that is the end of tape 3, The Big Book Experience.